the way they sobbed. It hurts, Mummy. It hurts so much.
Sit up, said Perry. Honey, sit up. He crouched down next to her, pulled her up into a sitting position, and gently laid an ice pack wrapped in a tea towel on the back of her head. As the blessed coldness began to seep through, she turned her head and studied his face through blurry eyes. It was dead white, with purplish crescents under his eyes. His features were dragged downward as though he were being ravaged by some terrible disease. He sobbed once, a grotesque, despairing sound, like an animal caught in a trap. She let herself fall forward against his shoulder, and they rocked together on their glossy black walnut floor beneath their soaring cathedral ceiling. Chapter 55. Madeline had often said that living and working in Pirrawee was like living in a country village. Mostly she adored that sense of community. Except, of course, on those days when PMS had her in its malicious grip, and she longed to walk through the shopping village without people smiling and waving and being so goddamned nice. Everyone was connected to everyone in Pirrawee, often in multiple ways, through the school or the surf club, the kids' sporting teams, the gym, the hairdresser, and so on. It meant that when she sat at her desk in her tiny, crammed office in the Pirrawee Theatre, and made a quick call to the Pirrawee local paper to see if she could get a last-minute quarter-page ad in next week's paper. They urgently needed more numbers for the preschooler's drama class to help bring in some cash. She wasn't just calling Lorraine, advertising representative. She was calling Lorraine, who had a daughter, Petra, in the same year as Abigail, and a son in year four at Pirrawee Public, and was married to Alec, who owned the local bottle shop and played in an over-40 soccer club with Ed. It wouldn't be a quick call, because she and Lorraine hadn't talked for a while. She realized this as the phone was ringing, and nearly hung up and sent an email instead. She had a lot to do today, and she was already running late from going to the assembly. But still, just a quick chat with Lorraine would be nice. And she did want to hear what Lorraine had heard about the petition and so on. But then again, Lorraine did go on sometimes, and Lorraine Edgley! Too late. Hi, Lorraine, said Madeline. It's Madeline. Darling! Lorraine should really work for the theatre, not the local paper. She had that flamboyant theatre talk down pat. How are you? Oh, my God, we should have coffee. We must have coffee. There's so much to talk about, said Lorraine. She lowered her voice so much, it became muffled. Lorraine worked in a busy open-plan office. I have gossip hot off the press. I have sizzling hot gossip. Give it to me now, said Madeline happily, settling back and resting her feet. Right this minute. Okay, here's a hint, said Lorraine. Parlez-vous anglais? Yes, I do speak English, said Madeline. That's all I can say in French, said Lorraine. So this is a French matter?
A French matter? Said Madeline confusedly.
Yes, and... And it relates to our mutual friend, Renata?
Is this something to do with the petition? Said Madeline. Because I hope you haven't signed it, Lorraine. Amabella hasn't even said that it is Ziggy who has been hurting her, and the school is monitoring the class now every single day.
Yeah, I thought a petition was a bit dramatic. Although I did hear the child's mother made Amabella cry and then kicked Harper in the sandpit. So I guess there are two sides to every story. But no, this is nothing to do with the petition, Madeline. I'm talking about a French matter.
The nanny, said Madeline with a flash of inspiration. Is that who you mean? Juliet? What about her?
Apparently, this bullying had been going on for ages, and that Juliet didn't even, yes, yes, that's who I mean, but forget the petition. It's a, how can I say this? It's related to our mutual friend's husband. And the nanny, said Madeline. Exactly, said Lorraine. I don't under... No. Madeline put her feet back on the floor and sat up straight. You're not serious. Jeff and the nanny. It was impossible not to feel a rush of pleasure at the tabloid-type shock of it. Rule-following, righteous, bird-watching, paunchy Jeff and the young French nanny. It was such an appallingly delicious cliché. They're having an affair? Yeah, just like Romeo and Juliet, except it's, you know, Jeff and Juliet, said Lorraine, who had apparently given up hope of trying to keep the details of her conversation secret from her colleagues. Madeline felt a slightly sick feeling, as if she'd scoffed down something sickly sweet and bad for her. That's awful. That's horrendous. She wished Renata ill, but she didn't wish her this. The only woman who deserved a philandering husband was a philandering wife. Does Renata know? Apparently not, said Lorraine. But it's confirmed. Jeff told Andrew Faraday at Squash, and Andrew told Shane, who told Alec. Men are such shocking gossips. Someone has to tell her, said Madeline. Well, it won't be me, said Lorraine. Shoot the messenger and all that. It can't be me, said Madeline. I'm the last person she should hear it from. Just don't tell anyone, said Lorraine. I promised Alec I wouldn't tell a soul. Right, said Madeline. No doubt this juicy piece of gossip was hurtling its way like a pinball across the peninsula, bouncing from friend to friend, husband to wife, and would soon enough hit poor Renata smack in the face, just when the poor woman thought the most stressful thing going on in her life was her daughter being bullied at school. Apparently, little Juliette wants to take him to meet her parents in France, said Lorraine, putting on a French accent. Ooh la la! Oh, enough, Lorraine, said Madeline sharply. It's not funny. I don't want to hear any more. It was completely unfair, seeing as she'd relished receiving the gossip in the first place. Sorry, darling, said Lorraine, unperturbed. What can I do for you anyway? Madeline made the booking, and Lorraine handled it with her usual efficiency, and Madeline wished she'd just sent her an email. So, I'll see you on Saturday night, said Lorraine. Saturday night? Oh, of course, the trivia night, said Madeline. She spoke warmly to make up for her earlier sharpness. Looking forward to it. I've got a new dress. I bet you have, said Lorraine. I'm going as Elvis. No rules say the women have to go as Audrey and the men have to go as Elvis. Madeline laughed, feeling fond of Lorraine again, whose big, loud, raucous laugh would set the tone for a fun night. I'll see you then, said Lorraine. Oh, hey, what's this charity thing that Abigail is doing? I'm not sure exactly, said Madeline. She's raising money for Amnesty International, doing something. Maybe a raffle? Actually, I should tell her she needs to get a permit to run a raffle. Said Lorraine. What? Said Madeline. What? Madeline swung her swivel chair around, and her elbow knocked a manila folder off the corner of her desk. She caught it in time. What's going on? I don't know, said Lorraine. Petra just mentioned something about this project Abigail was doing, and I got the feeling that there was something, I don't know, a bit off about it. Petra was giggling, being all irritating and silly, and making these obscure references about some of the other girls not approving of what Abigail was doing. But Petra approved, which is no great endorsement. Sorry, I'm being a bit vague, just that my mother instincts went a little, you know, wah, wah, wah. She made a sound like a car alarm. Madeline remembered now that strange comment that somebody had made on Abigail's Facebook page. She'd forgotten all about it because she'd been distracted by her rage over the cancellation of the math tutor. "I'll find out," she said. "Thanks for the heads up." "It's probably nothing." "Au revoir, doll." Lorraine hung up. Madeline picked up her phone and sent Abigail a text. "Call me as soon as you get this. Mum. Kiss." She'd be in class now, and the kids weren't meant to look at their phones until school hours were over. "Patience," she told herself as she put her hands back on the keyboard. "Right. What next?" The posters to promote next month's King Lear. Nobody in Pirouette wanted to see King Lear lurching madly about the stage. They wanted contemporary comedy. They had enough Shakespearean drama in their own lives in the school playground and on the soccer field. But Madeline's boss insisted. Ticket sales would be sluggish, and she'd subtly blame Madeline's marketing. It happened every year. She looked at the phone again. Abigail would probably make her wait till later tonight before she finally called. "How sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child, Abigail," she said to the silent phone. She could quote great chunks of King Lear, thanks to having to listen to the cast rehearsing so often. The phone rang, making her jump. It was Nathan. "Don't get upset," he said. Chapter 56. Violent relationships tend to become more violent over time. Had she read it in some of that folder of paperwork? Or was it something Susie had said in that cool, non-judgmental voice of hers? Celeste lay on her side in bed, hugging her pillow to her and looking out the window where Perry had pulled the curtain so she could see the sea. "We'll be able to lie in bed and see the ocean," he'd crowed when they'd first looked at this house. And the real estate agent had shrewdly said, "I'll leave you to look on your own." Because, of course, the house spoke for itself. Perry had been like a kid that day, an excited kid running through a new house. Not a man about to spend millions on a prestige ocean view property. Most of the time she forgot that he was 5 years younger than she was. But that day he'd seemed so very young, and she'd felt such tenderness toward him. His excitement almost frightened her. It was too raw and optimistic. She'd been right to be superstitious. They were surely heading for a fall. She was 14 weeks pregnant at the time, nauseated and bloated, with a permanent metallic taste in her mouth, and she was refusing to believe in this pregnancy. But Perry was high on hope, as if the new house would somehow guarantee the pregnancy would work, because what a life! What a life for children, living this close to the beach! That was before he'd ever even raised his voice to her, when the idea of his hitting her would have been impossible, inconceivable, laughable. She was still so shocked. It was just so very, very surprising. She'd tried so hard to convey the depth of her shock to Susie, but something told her that all of Susie's clients felt the same way. "But no, you see, for us, it's really surprising," she wanted to say. "More tea?" Perry stood at the bedroom door. He was still in his work clothes, but he'd taken off his jacket and tie and rolled the sleeves of his shirt up above his elbows.
I have to go into the office this afternoon, but I'll work from home this morning to make sure you're okay, he'd said, after he'd helped her off the hallway floor,
as if she'd slipped and hurt herself, or been suddenly overcome by a dizzy spell. He'd called Madeline without asking Celeste and asked if she would mind picking the boys up from school today.
Celeste is sick, she'd heard him say, and the concern and compassion in his voice was so real, so genuine. It was as though he really did believe that she'd suddenly been felled by a mysterious illness. Maybe he did believe it.
No thanks, she said. She looked at his handsome, caring face, blinked, and saw his face up close to hers, jeering.
Not good enough, before he slammed her head against the wall.
So surprising. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Which one was the baddie? She didn't know. She closed her eyes. The ice pack had helped, but the pain had settled at a certain level and stayed that way, as if it were always going to be there. A tender, throbbing circle. When she put her fingertips to it, she expected it to feel like a pulpy tomato.
Okay, well, sing out if you need anything.
She almost laughed. I will, she said. He left, and she closed her eyes. She'd embarrassed him. Would he feel embarrassed if she really did leave? Would he feel humiliated if the world knew that his Facebook posts didn't tell the whole story?
You need to take precautions. The most dangerous time for a battered woman is after she ends the relationship, Susie had told Celeste more than once at their last session, as though she were looking for a response that Celeste wasn't giving her. Celeste had never taken that seriously. For her, it was always about making the decision to leave, to stay or to go, as though going would be the end of her story. She was delusional. She was a fool. If his anger had burned just a notch higher today, then he would have hit her head once more against the wall. He would have hit harder. He could have killed her. And then he would have sunk to his knees and cradled her body, keening and shouting and feeling really very upset and sorry for himself. But so what? She'd be dead. He could never make it up to her. Her boys would have no mother. And Perry was a wonderful father, but he didn't give them enough fruit, and he always forgot to clean their teeth. And she wanted to see them grown up. If she left, he would probably kill her. If she stayed and they remained on this trajectory together, he would probably, eventually, find something to be angry enough about that he would kill her. There was no way out. An apartment with neatly made beds was no escape plan. It was a joke. It was just so very surprising that the good-looking, worried man who had just offered her a cup of tea and was right now working at his computer down the hallway and who would come running if she called him and who loved her with all of his strange heart would, in all probability, one day kill her.
Chapter 57
Abigail has built a website, said Nathan.
Okay, said Madeline. She had stood up from her desk as if she had to leave for somewhere, right now. The school? The hospital? Jail? What could be so momentous about a website?
It's to raise funds for Amnesty International, said Nathan. It's very professionally put together. I've been helping her with this web design course she's doing at school, but obviously I didn't... I didn't foresee this.
I don't get it. What's the problem? Said Madeline sharply. It wasn't like Nathan to see a problem when there wasn't one. He was more likely to miss a problem that was staring him in the face.
Nathan cleared his throat. He spoke in a strangled voice.
It's not the end of the world, but it's certainly not ideal.
Nathan!
Madeline stamped her foot in frustration.
Fine, said Nathan.
He spoke in a rush. Abigail is auctioning off her virginity to the highest bidder as a way of raising awareness for child marriage and sex slavery. She says, if the world stands by while a 7-year-old is sold for sex, then the world shouldn't blink an eye if a privileged white 14-year-old girl sells herself for sex.
All the money raised will go to Amnesty International.
She can't spell privileged.
Madeline sank back down in her chair. Oh, calamity.
Give me the address, said Madeline. Is the site live? Are you telling me the site is actually live right now?
Yes, said Nathan. I think it went up yesterday morning.
Don't look at it. Please, don't look at it. The problem is that she hasn't set it up so she can moderate comments, and naturally the internet trolls are in a feeding frenzy. Give me the address right now.
No.
Nathan! You give me the address right now!
She stomped her foot, almost in tears of frustration.
It's www.buymyvirginitytostopchildmarriageandsexslavery.com.
Fabulous, said Madeline, as she typed in the address with shaky hands. That's going to attract a wonderful class of charitable person.
Our daughter is an idiot. We raised an idiot.
Oh, wait. You didn't raise her. I raised her. I've raised an idiot.
She paused.
Oh, God.
You're looking at it? Said Nathan.
Yes, said Madeline.
It was a professional-looking website, which made it worse for some reason, more real, more official, as if the right for some stranger to purchase Abigail's virginity had been officially endorsed. The home page featured the photo of Abigail doing her yoga pose that Madeline had seen on her Facebook page. Viewed in the context of "Buy My Virginity," the photo took on a sinister sexuality. The hair falling over her shoulder, the long, skinny limbs, the small, perfect breasts. Men were looking at her daughter's photo on their computer screens and thinking about having sex with her.
I think I'm going to be sick, said Madeline.
I know, said Nathan. Madeline took a breath and clicked through the site with her professional marketing and PR eye. Along with the photo of Abigail, there were also images from the Amnesty International website about child marriage and sex slavery. Abigail had presumably helped herself without asking permission. The copy was good. Straightforward, persuasive, emotional without being over the top. Apart from the typo and the word privileged, and the fact that the entire premise was horrifyingly flawed, it was hugely impressive for a 14-year-old.
Is this even legal? She said after a moment. It must be illegal for an underage child to sell her virginity.
It would be illegal for someone to buy it, said Nathan.
She could tell he was speaking through gritted teeth. For a moment, Madeline felt disoriented as she realized that she was talking to Nathan. She must have subconsciously felt as though she were dealing with Ed, because she'd never before had to discuss a tricky parenting problem with Nathan. She set the rules, and Nathan followed them. They weren't a team. But the thought simultaneously occurred to her that if it were Ed, it wouldn't be the same. Ed would be horrified at the thought of a man buying Abigail's virginity. Of course he would. But he wouldn't be experiencing the visceral agony that Nathan was feeling. If it were Chloe, yes. But there was that subtle distance in his relationship with Abigail. The distance Madeline had always denied, and yet Abigail had always felt. She clicked on the section for bids and donations. Abigail had set it up so that people could leave comments and register their bids. The words swam in front of her.
How much for a gangbang? You can suck my cock for $20, anytime, any place. Hey, pretty little girl, I'll fuck that tight little cunt of yours for free.
Madeline pushed herself back away from her desk, the taste of bile in her mouth.
How do we shut this website down right now? Do you know how to shut it down?
She was pleased to note that she hadn't lost control, that she was speaking as if this were a work crisis, a leaflet that needed reprinting, a mistake on the theatre website. Nathan was tech-savvy. He must know what to do. But as she clicked off the comments page and saw the photo of Abigail again, her innocent, ridiculous, misguided daughter. Vile men were thinking and saying vile things about her little girl. Her anger rose volcanically from the pit of her stomach and burst from her mouth.
How the hell did this happen? Why weren't you and Bonnie watching what she was doing? You fix it! Fix it now!
Harper. Has anyone told you about Madeline's daughter's little drama? I mean, I hate to say it, but as I said to Renata at the time, she was over at my place for dinner, I think. I said, now that wouldn't happen at a private school. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with public high schools per se. I just think your children are more likely to interact with, you know, a better class of person.
Samantha, that Harper is so up herself. Of course it could have happened at a private school, and Abigail's intentions were so noble. It's just that 14-year-old girls are stupid.
Poor Madeline. She blamed Nathan and Bonnie, although I don't know if that was fair.
Bonnie.
Yes, Madeline did blame us. I accept that. Abigail was in my care at the time. But that had absolutely nothing to do with the tragedy. Nothing at all.
Chapter 58. After their visit to the psychologist, Jane drove Ziggy down to the beach to have some morning tea at Blue Blue's before she took him back to school.
The special today is apple pancakes with lemon spiced butter, said Tom. I think you should try some. On the house.
On the house? Frowned Ziggy.
For free, explained Jane. She smiled up at Tom, but I think we should pay.
Tom was always giving her free food. It was starting to get embarrassing. She wondered if he had somehow gotten the impression she was poverty-stricken.
"We'll work that out later," Tom said with a little wave of his hand, which meant that he wouldn't accept any money from her, no matter how hard she tried. He disappeared into the kitchen. She and Ziggy both turned their faces to look at the ocean. There was a brisk breeze blowing, and the sea looked playful, with white wavelets dancing across the horizon. Jane breathed in the wonderful scents of Blue Blues and felt an intensely nostalgic feeling, as if the decision had already been made and she and Ziggy were definitely going to move. The lease on her apartment was up for renewal in 2 weeks' time. They could move somewhere brand new, put him into a new school, start afresh with their reputations unsullied. Even if the psychologist was right and Ziggy really was experiencing bullying himself, there was no way that Jane could make the school consider that a possibility. It would be like a strategic move, as if she were counter-suing. Accuse me of damages, and I'll accuse you right back. Anyhow, how could they possibly stay at a school where parents were signing a petition for them to leave? Everything had become too complicated now. People probably thought she'd attacked Harper in the sandpit and bullied Amabella. She had made Amabella cry, and she felt terrible about that. The only solution was to go. That was the right thing to do. The right thing for both of them. Perhaps it had been inevitable that her time at Pirrawee would end so disastrously. Her real, unadmitted reasons for coming here were so peculiar, so messed up and downright weird, that she couldn't even let herself properly articulate them. But perhaps coming here actually had been a strange, necessary step in some process, because something had healed in the last few months. Even while she'd been suffering the confusion and worry over Ziggy and the other mothers, her feelings for Saxon Banks had undergone a subtle change. She felt she could see him with clear eyes now. Saxon Banks was not a monster. He was just a man. Just your basic, nasty thug. They were a dime a dozen. It was preferable not to sleep with them, but she had, and that was that. Ziggy was here. Perhaps only Saxon Banks had sufficiently thuggish enough sperm to get past her fertility issues. Perhaps he really was the only man in the world who could have given her a baby. And perhaps she could now find a fair, balanced way to talk about him, so that Ziggy stopped thinking his father was some kind of sinister supervillain. "Ziggy," she said, "would you like us to move to another school, where you could make brand new friends?" "Nope," said Ziggy. He seemed in a cheeky, quirky, flip mood right now. Not at all anxious. Did that psychologist know what she was talking about? What did Madeline always say? Children are so weird and random. "Oh," said Jane. "Why not? You were very upset the other day when those children said they weren't, you know, allowed to play with you." "Yeah," said Ziggy cheerfully. "But I've got lots of other friends who are allowed to play with me, like Chloe and Fred. Even though Fred is in year two, he's still my friend, because we both like Star Wars. And I've got other friends too, like Harrison and Amabella and Henry." "Did you say Amabella?" said Jane. He'd never actually mentioned playing with Amabella before, which was part of the reason it had seemed so unlikely that he'd been bullying her. She thought they travelled in different circles, so to speak. "Amabella likes Star Wars too," said Ziggy. "She knows all this stuff because she's a really super good reader. So we don't really play. But sometimes if I'm a bit tired of running, we sit together under the sea dragon tree and talk about Star Wars stuff." "Amabella Klein? Amabella in kindergarten?" checked Jane. "Yeah, Amabella. Except the teachers won't let us talk anymore," sighed Ziggy. "Well, that's because Amabella's parents think you've been hurting her," said Jane, with a touch of exasperation. "It's not me who hurt her," said Ziggy, half sliding off his chair in that profoundly annoying way of little boys. She'd been relieved to see Fred doing exactly the same thing.
Sit up, said Jane sharply.
He sat up and sighed. I'm hungry. Do you think my pancakes are coming soon?
He craned his neck to look back toward the kitchen. Jane surveyed him. The words he'd just said registered properly. It's not me who hurt her.
Ziggy, she said. Had she asked him this question before? Had anyone asked him this question? Or had they all just said over and over, was it you, Ziggy? Was it you?
What? He said.
Do you know who has been hurting Amabella?
It happened instantly. His face closed down. I don't want to talk about it. His lower lip trembled.
But just tell me, sweetheart. Do you know?
I promised, said Ziggy softly. Jane leaned forward.
You promised what?
I promised Amabella I wouldn't tell anyone ever. She said if I told anyone, she would probably get killed dead.
Killed dead, repeated Jane.
Yes, said Ziggy passionately. His eyes filled with tears. Jane tapped her fingers. She knew he wanted to tell her.
What if, she said slowly, what if you wrote down the name?
Ziggy frowned. He blinked and brushed away the tears.
Because then you're not breaking your promise to Amabella. That's not like telling me.
And I promise you that Amabella will not get killed dead. Ziggy considered this.
Jane pulled a notebook and pen from her bag and pushed it toward him.
Can you spell it? Or just have a go at spelling it? That's what they were taught at school, to have a go with their writing.
Ziggy took the pen and then he turned around, distracted by the cafe door opening. Two people came inside, a woman with a blonde bob and an unremarkable businessman. Graying, middle-aged men in suits all looked pretty much the same to Jane.
That's Emily J's mum, said Ziggy.
Harper. Jane felt her face flush as she remembered the mortifying incident in the sandpit where Harper had accused her of assault. There had been a strained call from Mrs. Lipman that night advising Jane that a parent had made an official complaint against her and suggesting that she lay low, so to speak, until this difficult matter was resolved. Harper glanced her way, and Jane felt her heart race as if with a terrible fear. For God's sake, she's not going to kill you, she thought. It was so strange to be in a state of intense conflict with a person she barely knew. Jane had spent most of her grown-up life sidestepping confrontations. It was mystifying to her that Madeline could enjoy this sort of thing and actually seek it out. This was awful, embarrassing, awkward, and distressing. Harper's husband tapped one finger smartly on the bell on the counter. Ding! To summon Tom from the kitchen. The cafe wasn't busy. There was a woman with a baby in the far right-hand corner and a couple of men in paint-splattered blue overalls eating egg and bacon rolls. Jane saw Harper nudge her husband and speak in his ear. He looked over at Jane and Ziggy. Oh, God, he was coming over. He had one of those big, firm beer bellies he carried proudly, as if it were a badge of honour. "Hi there," he said to Jane, holding out his hand. "Jane, is it? I'm Graham, Emily's dad." Jane shook his hand. He squeezed just hard enough to let her know that he was making the decision not to squeeze any harder. "Hello," she said. "This is Ziggy."
G'day, mate.
Graham's eyes flickered towards Ziggy and then straight back again.
Please leave it, Graham, said Harper, who had come to stand next to him.
She studiously ignored Jane and Ziggy. It was like at school in the sandpit when she'd played that freaky avoid eye contact at all costs game.
Listen, Jane, said Graham. Obviously, I don't want to say too much in front of your son here, but I understand you're embroiled in some sort of dispute with the school, and I don't know the ins and outs of all that, and frankly, I'm not that interested. But let me tell you this, Jane.
He placed both palms on the table and leaned over her. It was such a calculated, intimidating move. It was almost comical. Jane lifted her chin. She needed to swallow, but she didn't want him to see her gulping nervously. She could see the deep lines around his eyes, a tiny mole next to his nose. He was doing that ugly teeth-jutting thing that a certain type of shirtless, tattooed man did when he was yelling at reporters on tabloid television.
We've decided not to get the police involved this time, but if I hear that you go near my wife again, I'll be taking out a restraining order against you quick smart, Jane, because I will not stand for this. I'm a partner in a law firm, and I will bring the full weight of the law down on your...
You need to leave now. It was Tom, carrying a plate of pancakes. He placed the plate on Jane's table and cupped one hand gently over the back of Ziggy's head.
Oh, Tom, I'm sorry, we just... fluttered Harper.
The mothers of Pirouette were addicted to Tom's coffee and treated him as a beloved drug dealer. Graham straightened and pulled once on his tie.
All okay here, mate?
No, said Tom, it's not. I won't have you harassing my customers. I'd like you to leave right now. Tom's teeth weren't jutting, but his jaw was clenched. Graham tapped his closed fist, knuckles down on Jane's table.
Look, legally, mate, I don't think you actually have the right to...
I don't want legal advice, said Tom. I am asking you to leave.
Oh, Tom, I'm so sorry, said Harper. We certainly didn't mean...
I'm sure I'll see you both another time, said Tom. He went to the door and held it open. Just not today.
Fine, said Graham.
He turned and pointed a finger an inch away from Jane's nose.
Remember what I said, young lady, because get out before I throw you out,
said Tom, dangerously quiet. Graham straightened. He looked at Tom.
You lost yourself a customer, he said, as he followed his wife out the door. I certainly hope so, said Tom.
He let the door go and turned and looked back at his customers. Sorry about that. One of the men in overalls clapped.
Good on you, mate.
The woman with the baby stared curiously at Jane. Ziggy twisted around in his seat to look out the glass windows at Harper and Graham hurrying off down the boardwalk. Then he shrugged, picked up his fork, and began to eat his pancakes with gusto. Tom came over to Jane and crouched down beside her, his arm on the back of her chair.
You okay?
Jane took a deep, shaky breath. Tom smelled sweet and clean. He always had that distinctive, fresh, clean smell because he surfed twice a day, followed by a long, hot shower. She knew this because he'd once told her that he stood under the hot water, replaying all the best waves he'd just caught. It occurred to Jane that she loved Tom, just as she loved Madeline and Celeste, and that it would break her heart to leave Pirrawee, but that it was impossible to stay. She'd made real friends here, but she'd also made real enemies. There was no future for her here. "I'm okay," she said. "Thank you. Thank you for that."
"Excuse me. Oh, dear, I'm sorry."
The baby had just spilled his drink all over the floor and was crying. Tom put his hand on Jane's arm. "Don't let Ziggy eat all those pancakes." He stood and went over to help the woman, saying, "It's okay, little buddy. I'm gonna get you another one." Jane picked up her fork and took a mouthful of the apple pancakes. She closed her eyes. Tom was going to make some lucky man extremely happy one day.
"I wrote it down," said Ziggy.
"Wrote what down?" Jane used her fork to cut another edge of the pancake. She was trying not to think of Harper's husband, the way he'd leaned over her. His intimidation tactics were absurd, but they'd also worked. She'd felt intimidated. And now she felt ashamed. Had she deserved it? Because she'd kicked at Harper in the sandpit? But she hadn't actually kicked Harper. She was positive she hadn't actually made contact. But still, she'd let her temper get the better of her. She'd behaved badly, and Harper had gone home upset, and she had a loving, overprotective husband who had felt angry on her behalf.
"The name," said Ziggy.
He pushed the notepad at her.
"The name of the kid who does stuff to Amabella."
Samantha. "So apparently Harper's husband won't let her go into Blue Blues anymore." I said, "Harper, it's not 1950. Your husband can't forbid you to go into a cafe." But she said he'd see it as a betrayal. Bugger that. I'd betray Stu for Tom's coffee. Jeez, I'd murder for it. I'm not the murderer, though, if that's what you're thinking. I don't think coffee was involved. Jane put down her fork and pulled the notebook toward her. Ziggy had scrawled four letters across the page. Some were enormous, some were tiny. M-A-K-S.
"Max," said Jane. "There's no one called..."
She stopped. Oh, calamity. "Do you mean Max?" Ziggy nodded.
"The mean twin."
Chapter 59. "It's 2 o'clock. I'm going for my meeting now," said Perry. "Madeline is picking up the kids. I'm going to be back by 4, so just stick them in front of the TV until I'm home. How are you feeling?" Celeste looked up at him. It was a kind of lunacy, really, the way he could behave like this, as if she were in bed with a bad migraine. As if this had nothing to do with him. The more time that passed, the less anguished he looked. His guilt slowly seeped away. His body metabolized it, like alcohol. And she colluded in his lunacy. She went along with it. She was behaving as if she were ill. She was letting him take care of her. They were both crazy. "I'm all right," she said. He'd just given her a strong painkiller. She normally resisted analgesics because she was so susceptible to them, but the pain in her head had finally become more than she could stand. Within minutes, the pain had begun to melt away, but everything else was melting as well. She could feel her limbs becoming heavy and somnolent. The walls of the bedroom seemed to soften, and her thoughts became languid, as if she were sunbathing on a hot summer's day.
When you were little, she said. Yes. Perry sat beside her and held her hand. That year, she said, that year when you were bullied.
He smiled, when I was a fat little kid wearing glasses.
It was bad, wasn't it? She said. You laugh about it, but it was a really bad year.
He squeezed her hand. Yes, it was bad. It was very bad.
What was her point? She couldn't turn it into words. Something to do with the frustrated anger of a terrorized 8-year-old, and how she always wondered if that's what this was all about. Each time Perry felt disrespected or humiliated, Celeste bore the brunt of a fat little boy's violent, suppressed rage. Except that now he was a 6-foot man.
It was Saxon who helped you in the end, wasn't it? She said. Her words were melting too. She could hear it. Saxon knocked out the ringleader's front tooth, said Perry. He chuckled. Never got picked on again.
Right, said Celeste.
Saxon Banks. Perry's hero. Jane's tormentor. Ziggy's father. Ever since the night of the book club, Saxon had been in the back of her mind. She and Jane had something in common. They had both been hurt by these men. These handsome, successful, cruel cousins. Celeste felt responsible for what Saxon had done to Jane. She was so young and vulnerable. If only Celeste had been there to protect her. She had experience. She could hit and scratch when necessary. There was some connection she was trying to make. A fleeting thought she couldn't catch, like something half-glimpsed in her peripheral vision. It had been bugging her for a while. What was Saxon's excuse for behaving the way he did? He hadn't been bullied as a child, as far as Celeste knew. So did that mean Perry's behavior wasn't anything to do with the year he was bullied? It was a family trait they shared?
But you're not as bad as him, she mumbled.
Wasn't that the only point?
Yes, that was key. That was key to everything.
What? Perry looked bemused.
You wouldn't do that.
Wouldn't do what? Said Perry.
So sleepy, said Celeste.
I know, said Perry. Go to sleep now, honey. He pulled the sheets up under her chin and pushed her hair off her face. I'll be back soon. As she succumbed to sleep, she thought she heard him whisper in her ear, I'm so sorry. But she might have already been dreaming.
Chapter 60. I can't bloody shut it down, said Nathan. If I could have shut it down, don't you think I would have? Before I called you? It's a public website, held on a server that's not inside the house. I can't just flick a switch. I need her login details. I need her password. Miss Polly had a dolly, shouted Madeline. That's the password. She's got the same password for everything. Go shut it down.
She'd always known Abigail's passwords for her social media accounts. That was the deal, so Madeline could check in any time. Along with the understanding that Madeline was allowed to silently creep into Abigail's bedroom at random moments like a cat burglar and look over her shoulder at the computer screen for as long as it took Abigail to notice she was standing there, which often took a while, because Madeline had a special talent for creeping. It drove Abigail crazy and made her jump out of her skin each time she finally sensed Madeline's presence, but Madeline didn't care. That was good parenting in this day and age. You spied on your children,
And that was why this would never have happened if Abigail had been at home where she belonged. I've tried Miss Polly had a dolly, said Nathan heavily. It's not that.
You mustn't be doing it right. It's all lowercase, no spaces. It's always...
I told her just the other day that she shouldn't have the same password for everything, said Nathan. She must have listened to me.
Right, said Madeline.
Her anger had cooled and solidified into something mammoth and glacial.
Good one. Good advice. Great fathering.
It's because of identity theft.
Whatever.
Be quiet. Let me think. She tapped two fingers rapidly against her mouth.
Have you got a pen?
Of course I've got a pen.
Try Huckleberry.
Why Huckleberry?
It was her first pet, a puppy. We had her for 2 weeks. She got run over. Abigail was devastated. You were... Where were you?
Bali? Vanuatu? Who knows? Don't ask questions. Just listen. She listed off 20 potential passwords in quick succession. Bands, TV characters, authors, and random things like chocolate and I hate mum.
It won't be that, said Nathan.
Madeline ignored him. She was filled with despair at the impossibility of the task. It could be anything, any combination of letters and numbers.
Are you sure there is no other way to do this? She said.
I was thinking I could try to redirect the Dename name, said Nathan, but then I still need to log into her account. The world revolves around logins. I guess some IT genius might be able to hack into the site. It's just a Google hosting account, but that would take time. We'll get it down eventually, but obviously the fastest way is for her to do it herself.
Yes, said Madeline. She'd already pulled her car keys from her bag. I'm going to get her out of school early.
We just have to tell her to take it down.
Madeline could hear the keyboard clattering as he tried the different passwords.
We're her parents. We have to tell her that there will be consequences if she doesn't listen to us.
It was sort of hilarious hearing Nathan using modern parenting terminology like consequences.
Right, and that's going to be so easy, said Madeline. She's 14. She thinks she's saving the world, and she's as stubborn as a mule.
We'll tell her she's grounded, said Nathan excitedly, obviously remembering that's what parents did to teenagers on American sitcoms.
She'd love that. She'll see herself as a martyr to the cause.
But I mean, for God's sake, surely she's not serious, said Nathan. She's not really planning to actually go through with this, to have sex with some stranger.
I just can't. She's never even had a boyfriend, has she?
As far as I know, she hasn't even kissed a boy, said Madeline. And she wanted to cry, because she knew exactly what Abigail would say in response to that. Those little girls haven't kissed any boys either. She squeezed the keys tight in her hand.
I better rush. I've only just got time before I pick up the little kids.
She remembered then that Perry had called earlier to ask if she'd pick up the twins because Celeste was sick. Her left eyelid began to twitch.
Madeline, said Nathan, don't yell at her, will you? Because
are you kidding?
Of course I'm going to yell at her, yelled Madeline. She's selling her virginity on the internet.
Chapter 61. Jane drove Ziggy up to the school after their morning tea at Blue Blues.
Will you tell Max to stop hurting Amabella? He said to her as she parked the car.
A grown-up will talk to him, said Jane, as she turned the key in the ignition. Probably not me. Maybe Miss Barnes. She was trying to work out the best way to handle this. Should she march